If you want this badly enough, and it appears as though you do, it'll happen. And when it does, I'm afraid you and me are gonna butt heads somewhere down the road. I hope we don't, I said. But if we do, it'd probably be best if you wear a helmet. Now, if there isn't anything else, get out of my apartment. You can take the beer with you. Chapter 17. I have to admit I was a little nervous as I drove through the switchbacks on the steady climb up the mountain to Granny Tipton's to meet Senator Roger Tate. The plan, I'd been told, was to have lunch and later discuss the things that needed discussing. I could ask whatever I wanted, except I was forbidden to mention the dalliances of the senator's youth, and he could ask whatever he wanted. If he brought up the people I'd killed, Granny told me to deny it. No sense giving him any leverage he didn't need to have. If he asked about Ben Clancy specifically, she said she'd handle that one herself. It was a hot and humid day as I moved slowly past the rhododendrons and mountain laurels, stands of old oak and elms, and skirted the creeks that rushed down the mountain, swollen from the unusual amount of rain we'd had that summer. When I got to Granny's, I was shocked to see a helicopter in the field between her driveway and the creek. The senator obviously traveled in style. Two men I assumed were a pilot and maybe a security guy were walking near the chopper. When I walked into Granny's house, the first person I saw after Granny was Claire Tate. She was standing in the living room looking at photographs on the wall, pictures I'd looked at several times. She was wearing tight black jeans and a pale blue silk shirt. She was incredibly striking. Granny led me through the house and into the kitchen, and there, looking out the kitchen window above the sink, was the senior senator from Tennessee, and one of the most powerful men in the country. He turned as he heard us walk in and smiled broadly, revealing perfect white teeth. Senator Tate was a little over 6 feet tall with silver hair and bright sky blue eyes. He was fit and trim and looked like he could run a marathon. He may have had some bad habits in his younger days, but the man standing before me took excellent care of himself. His skin was as smooth as any 70-year-old I'd ever seen, and his grip when he shook my hand was like a vice. "I've heard much about you, Mr. Street," he said, looking me squarely in the eye. "Some of it was good." He smiled and released my hand. It was a Thursday afternoon, but the smell of fried chicken filled the house. Fried chicken was usually reserved for Sundays in the mountains. "I hope you brought an appetite," Granny said. "These Washington folks said they usually eat salad, but this is Tennessee. I'm entertaining and I'm putting on the dog." "Smells great," I said. The senator, Claire, Granny, and I sat down to a meal of fried chicken, biscuits and gravy, mashed potatoes, green beans, fried okra, fresh tomatoes and onion slices, couscous, and chocolate pie. We washed it down with sweet tea. Claire, who looked like she'd prefer raw tuna, took it in stride. She didn't eat much, but she ate. The senator let it rip, and so did I. It was delicious. When we were finished, the four of us walked outside, and Granny led us down the path to the small clearing where she and I had talked once before. She was carrying a small cooler, and I took it from her hand and carried it until we sat down. She opened the cooler and produced a pitcher of iced lemonade and four plastic cups. "This is beautiful," Senator Tate said, looking at the surrounding mountains, the creek, and the meadow beyond. "Brings back a lot of fond memories of being outdoors. My understanding is that you were raised in the city, Mr. Street." "Sort of the outskirts of the city, over by Farragut before it developed the way it has now." "Do you like to get outdoors, hunt, or fish?" "Love to camp, and I've done a lot of fishing in my day. Not to say that I'm any good at it, but it clears my head. I used to take my son a lot." "Yes, your son. That would be Sean, correct?" "I see you've done your homework. Your first wife cheated on you, if you'll forgive me for saying so, with an older man. Very rich man. She moved with him to Hawaii and took your son with her." I didn't really see what my ex-wife Katie screwing an older man had to do with anything. The senator mentioning it stung a bit, but I let it go. "That's right," I said. Do you have any contact with him? He comes every summer. I stay in touch by calling, but it's difficult to get past his mother sometimes. She's not exactly what I would describe as a kind person. I want to extend my condolences for the death of your mother, and for what happened recently with Miss Alexander and your daughter. That was a terrible thing, from what I understand. Thank you, and yes, it was terrible. The doctor had some serious substance abuse issues that people were aware of prior to that day. He had no business practicing medicine. I've been told that he's gone. Nobody has heard from him in a couple of weeks. That's what I hear. What's your theory on his disappearance? Senator Tate said. My theory? I don't really have one, but if I did, it would probably be along the lines of he knew a huge lawsuit would be coming down the pike, and that the medical licensing board would be taking a close look at him, so he ran away to avoid the beating he knew he was about to take. So you don't think any harm has come to him? I don't know, Senator, but if harm did come to him, it couldn't have come to a more deserving person. So Elizabeth tells me you'd like to be the next district attorney general in Knoxville, Senator Tate said. Tell me, if you don't mind, why you would want such a dirty job. He spoke with a slow mountain drawl, a baritone that was almost mesmerizing. It was the kind of voice that could hypnotize an unsuspecting person into believing damn near anything he said. I was certain that his voice had played a major role in his political success. It was a voice of persuasion. I wondered briefly whether I should give him some flowery bullshit answer to the question he'd just asked me, or just tell him the truth. Then I thought about how many times he'd probably asked people questions just like the one he'd asked me. Thousands, I guessed. No point in trying to dress it up. I looked him in the eye. Because I can't stand Stephen Morris. He's gutless, and he doesn't deserve the job. Because I think I can help Granny and her family in certain ways. Because the system has let me down more than once, and I'm hoping maybe I can do better. And maybe I think I might be able to atone for some things I've done in the past, set some things right, at least in my own mind. You're trying to forgive yourself for the killings you've done, he said. If I ever killed anyone, sir, and I'm not saying I have, they deserved it. Sometimes the system fails us, Senator Tate said. It failed you by allowing you to be locked up for a crime you didn't commit and subjected you to things I can't even begin to imagine. And it failed you when your mother was killed. Although, to be perfectly frank, I don't believe you gave the system much of a chance when your mother was killed. You acted hastily. I don't really remember how I acted, sir, I said. I have very little recollection of that time in my life. You were far more methodical with Ben Clancy, he said. With all due respect, sir, I'd rather not discuss Ben Clancy. I'll discuss him, Granny said. He was a psychopath in a suit with the power of the federal government behind him. We did the world a favor when we got rid of him. We? Senator Tate said. I've never lied to you, Roger. We're old enough now that there isn't really any point in starting. We hanged him in my barn and fed him to my pigs. Darren was there. He played a major role in Clancy's death, as he should have. There isn't a trace left of Clancy, and I'm not the least bit ashamed of it. I felt a sudden wave of nausea run over me as I listened to the words coming out of Granny's mouth. I couldn't believe she just admitted murdering a former assistant U.S. attorney to a U.S. senator. I looked at Senator Tate. He just smiled and shook his head. I've always admired your candor, Elizabeth, he said. So good riddance to Mr. Clancy, and don't worry, your secret is safe with me. As is yours with me, she said with a wink. The senator cringed and his face flushed. It was the only time that day I saw him lose his composure, even though it was only for a second. Yes, and I appreciate that more than you know, Elizabeth, he said. Now, down to business. I'm prepared to do what it takes to get Darren elected to the office. Claire has already started setting up an organization. We're calling in favors from old friends, and believe me, because of my position on the Appropriations Committee, I have plenty of old friends. Money won't be a problem. We'll outspend Morris 10-1 if we have to, absolutely drown him. You'll have to do the dog and pony shows, the rubber chicken circuit. You'll have to speak to Ruritan clubs and veterans organizations and neighborhood associations. You'll have to speak to the press, but only under tightly controlled circumstances. Claire will advise you on all that. I don't even think we'll have to do a smear campaign on Morris. I hate doing that, for one thing, but he just seems to have done such a poor job, I think we can beat him without it. We can keep him busy putting out fires, start rumors and things like that, so he won't have time to pay much attention to you. Originally, I would have done these things just for Elizabeth, but something has happened, and I want your word that you'll do everything you can to investigate and, if a crime was committed, hold those responsible accountable, including the sheriff of Knox County. I shook my head slowly. It was an involuntary movement. "Am I to take that as a no?" the senator said. "I'm sorry, no. It's just that when you mentioned the sheriff, it threw me for a second. He showed up at my apartment yesterday, broke in. He was sitting at my kitchen counter when I came back from a run."
"What did he want?"
"He was trying to intimidate me. It didn't work out for him." "Good. My hope is that he's going to wind up behind bars where he belongs. But back to what has happened. A good friend of mine, Art Brewer, contacted me a few days ago. He lives here in Knoxville and has been extremely successful in the insurance business. He has a grandson, Gary, who graduated from the University of Tennessee and then joined the Marines because he wanted to join the fight against ISIS. He wound up leading combat platoons in Afghanistan and Syria, did 3 tours, was wounded several times, and was highly decorated. But he came home a changed young man. Art said he was haunted by nightmares, was paranoid and restless, had no interest in holding a job, and had turned to drugs and alcohol to medicate himself. Art also said that his son, Gary's father, told Art that Gary had gotten into bare-knuckle boxing, which I think is something akin to cockfighting using men instead of roosters. Gary's sister, who is the closest in the family to him, said he went off last Sunday to do a fight somewhere in the western part of the county, and he didn't come back. He hasn't been seen since. Art called the sheriff's department and, as you would expect, has received no help. The Knoxville police say it's out of their jurisdiction if it didn't happen in the city. District Attorney Morris has not asked the TBI to help with the investigation, and the FBI says they have jurisdictional problems as well.
"Not if official misconduct is involved," I said.
"Exactly," the senator said. "If a public official is engaged in corrupt practices, the FBI has every right. In fact, they have a responsibility to investigate."
"So why don't you pull a few strings?" I said. "Seems to me that you could get the FBI in Knoxville to do pretty much anything you want."
"I can, but they're going to need an in," he said.
"You mean an informant?"
"Call it what you like."
"You want me to get elected DA, act like I'm on the take like Stephen Morris and the sheriff, and help the FBI bust them all?"
"And find out what happened to Gary Brewer," the senator said. "That's the most important part. Find my good friend's grandson."
My stomach began to churn even worse than it had earlier. "I have to tell you, Senator Tate, I hate snitches. The thought of becoming one makes my skin crawl."
"But you'll do it," he said. "You'll do it for me, and for Grace, and for your own redemption."
I drowned the last of the lemonade in my glass and looked at him. "If you get me elected, I'll figure out a way to find out what happened to Gary Brewer and hold people accountable," I said. "I give you my word. But I have to draw the line at becoming an FBI informant. I just can't become a snitch for them. I've seen people do it, and it always turns out badly for the snitch. It's a deal-breaker, sir. I'm sorry." The senator looked at me sternly. He obviously wasn't used to people saying no to him.
"You'll find Gary Brewer," he said, "dead or alive. You'll make it your mission."
"I will."
"Very well. Let's get this done." Chapter 18. Sheriff Tree Corker squeezed off another round as gunshots echoed off the surrounding hills. The sheriff and Roby Penn were firing at rats that scurried around a garbage pile 50 yards away. They were on Roby's land, a forlorn 40-acre patch of woods and weeds about 7 miles northeast of Knoxville. The garbage heap had grown over the years as Roby had piled everything from old tires to rotted food, empty paint cans, and crumbling lumber. The rats had settled in about 5 years earlier, and now they were everywhere.
"You can't shoot for shit," Roby said as yet another blast emanated from the barrel of one of the sheriff's pythons.
Dirt shot up about 10 feet to the right of a rat that sat on its haunches, chewing on something it was holding in its paws.
"That wasn't even the one I was aiming for," the sheriff said. "He ducked down behind the pile just before I pulled the trigger."
"Yeah, right. And the Pope's a Buddhist," Roby said.
It was 10 in the morning on Sunday, and the heat and humidity were already starting to rise. The sheriff's cruiser sat nearby, a shiny black Ford LTD with large gold stars on the hood, the trunk lid, and both sides. The High Sheriff of Knox County was airbrushed in gold on each front quarter panel. The sheriff pulled a handkerchief from his pocket, lifted his cowboy hat, and wiped his forehead.
"Gonna be hotter than a 3-peckered billy goat today," he said.
He holstered his python and sat down on the tailgate of Roby's pickup truck as Roby took aim and fired with an illegal fully automatic M16, chambered in 5.56 millimeter. Roby squeezed the trigger, and a rat did a backflip as the round tore his head off.
"I hate rats," Roby muttered.
"Then why don't you clean up this damned mess?" the sheriff said. "All it'd take is some kerosene and a lighter."
"Because then I wouldn't be able to come out here and kill the little bastards. I said I hate rats. I didn't say I don't like killing them."
"So what are we gonna do about this Darren Street?" the sheriff said.
"I don't like it," Roby said. "Him just showing up out of nowhere like this. You think he might be a plant?"
"A plant? You mean some kind of informant?"
"Yeah. You think the NSA or the CIA might have sent him down here?"
"To do what?"
"Spy on us, you dumbass," Roby yelled. "Take us out. Maybe send us off to one of those Supermax federal pens I've heard about that's underground, and you don't ever see any light or hear any kind of noise."
The sheriff had noticed Roby getting stranger over the past year. Conspiracy theories such as the one he was spouting were becoming more common. He'd also noticed that Roby never seemed to sleep or eat. He drank whiskey like a town drunk, but the sheriff didn't remember the last time he'd seen Roby eat a sandwich.
"Nobody sent him here to spy on us," Tree said. "Relax. He just hates Morris."
"You said you talked to him?"
"Yeah. I broke into his apartment and surprised him."
"Talk about money?"
"It didn't come up. I didn't get the sense he was interested."
"Well, then we just keep making our money. Hell, maybe he won't even want to cut."
"I just don't know," Tree said. "I mean, it isn't like he's spick and span Mr. Clean or anything. He supposedly killed 5 men, and he had this look in his eyes when I talked to him. Like he wasn't afraid of anything or anybody. Like he didn't give a shit."
"He ain't killed no 5 men, Roby said. "He'd be in prison or dead."
"He's been in prison, but they sent him up for a murder he didn't commit, and he got out of it after a couple of years. There's a lot of stories about him. He's supposed to be a tough man. He makes me nervous."
Roby picked off another rat as the assault rifle cracked. He lowered the weapon to his side, turned to the sheriff, and said,
"If he bothers you so much, if you really think he's going to cause us problems, then take care of him."
"Take care of him how?"
"Figure something out. Make him have an accident."
"What kind of accident?"
"Damn it, Tree, do I have to figure everything out for you? You're the damn sheriff of Knox County. You've got as much power as God Almighty. You got deputies that'll do anything you ask them to do without batting an eye or asking a question. If you think he's going to be a problem, fuck him up. Kill him."
The sheriff hated it when Roby spoke to him about killing people as though it were nothing. He couldn't imagine taking a life, and he was afraid of and didn't understand people who thought nothing of it. Roby was one of those people, and the more the sheriff was around him, especially within the last year, the more he feared him. Roby had always been an angry man, but his anger had escalated.
Killing people isn't really my style, Roby. You know that.
I ain't killing him for you, not unless he gets into my business. Wait a minute. I'll take that back. I might kill him just for sport.
Don't kill him, Roby. He hasn't done anything to you. Let's just see how it goes.
See how it goes. Like it did with that Marine, I got stuck getting rid of him. You should have taken care of that.
You gonna start that up again? It happened at your place during one of your events. It was your responsibility. I'm dealing with the fallout, and believe me, there's plenty of it. His granddaddy and his daddy have been wearing me out.
What have you told them?
Roby turned to face the sheriff, and his eyes were like lasers, flashing heat and anger.
Same old, same old. We're investigating, we're on it, we're doing everything we can, but we don't have any leads. From what I understand, the Marine had gone pretty psycho lately. I'm trying to convince them that he's walking the Appalachian Trail or headed for the Grand Canyon or something. I keep telling them he'll pop up soon.
He won't, Roby said. He ain't never gonna pop up. As a matter of fact, he's in a barrel 6 feet under that garbage pile right there. Put him there myself with a front-end loader attachment to my tractor.
I wish you hadn't told me that, Tree said. I didn't want to know what you did with him.
Roby walked over to the bed of the truck, removed the clip from his rifle, cleared the round from the chamber, and laid the rifle in a case.
I gotta go, Tree, he said. There's a fight up in Hawkins County I want to see.
Bare knuckle? Roby nodded.
I ain't promoting, but I have a pretty good idea of who's going to win. I know the boy that runs the fights up there real well. One of the fighters is going to put on a good show and then take a dive. I'll take home enough money to make it worth a trip.
Give some thought to what we ought to do about this street, Tree said.
Roby shook his head.
I think it'd be better to do something about Morris. I wouldn't mind being rid of him once and for all.
You can't kill a district attorney, Roby, Tree said.
Didn't you tell me he said if he lost, he might go to the feds and tell them what we've been into for all these years?
The sheriff had let it slip and had regretted saying it the moment the words passed his lips.
He did say something like that, but I don't think he was serious.
Well, from my way of thinking, better to deal with him before he goes to the feds than after.
I don't think the feds really give a damn about us, Roby.
Maybe they don't. But you know how much I hate them. I hate them, I hate the TBI, I hate the police, the tax man. Anything to do with the government, I hate. Hell, I'd hate you if you weren't my nephew, and sometimes I hate you anyway. If the feds came nosing around, the bodies would start piling up pretty damn fast.
They'd just kill you, Tree said. You can't fight them. Remember Ruby Ridge, Waco? And the boys out west at that Malheur Wildlife Refuge last year didn't fare too well. One of them is dead and a bunch of them are in jail.
I ain't Randy Weaver or David Koresh or any of them others, Roby said. Feds, state troopers, TBI, I don't give a damn. They come messing around here, they're gonna die.
Chapter 19. I looked around at the trees full of bright green leaves, the calm water, and the sky dotted with high cumulus clouds as the pontoon boat made its way slowly eastward on the Tennessee River. We'd already passed Thompson Bowling Arena and the cavernous Neyland Stadium, and were headed for the fork where the Tennessee River split into the French Broad and Holston Rivers. I was at the wheel of a pontoon boat that had been rented by Claire Tate. Also on board were Claire and a reporter from the only daily newspaper left in the city, the Knoxville News Sentinel. The conversation had been sparse and felt forced. The reporter's name was Janie Schofield. I'd been reading her stories for years since she covered the criminal courts. She was around 50, a quiet brunette who wore glasses and stayed in the background most of the time. She didn't sensationalize and seemed serious about her work. I'd talked to her a few times over the years, but I couldn't say I knew her well. Janie was wearing a yellow sundress. She had a nice tan, and the color went well with her brown skin. Claire was covered in sunscreen. She was wearing a two-piece purple swimsuit with a pink wraparound cover-up and a pink, broad-brimmed hat. Both of them were wearing sunglasses. I was wearing blue swim trunks and a white tank top. We looked like a few friends out for an early afternoon cruise. All three of us had a can of beer in our hands, but nobody was drinking quickly. I stopped the boat about 50 yards off the shore of Island Home Park and dropped the anchor.
"I suppose you're wondering what we're doing out here on this lovely day," Claire said to Janie. "I think I might have a couple of educated guesses, but you certainly have my curiosity piqued," Janie said. "Darren is going to run against Stephen Morris for District Attorney General. I'm his campaign manager. My grandfather is supporting him openly. He'll be coming to Knoxville in late October to appear with Darren at a rally."
Janie looked at Claire, then at me, then back at Claire again.
"I'd heard a rumor that Mr. Street was planning a huge lawsuit against the doctor that was involved in the death of his little girl, and that he had asked your grandfather to intervene with the Tennessee Medical Licensing Board," she said. "My source was obviously mistaken."
"Obviously," Claire said. "We're giving you an exclusive, a scoop, in the old journalistic parlance, I believe."
"Yes, you are," Janie said. "What's the catch?"
"No catch, but I do have some other information I'd like you to check into through your own sources. If it turns out to be true, you may have a prize winner of a story on your hands."
"Is that right?" Janie said. She looked skeptical, which, I was sure, came with the territory in journalism, just like in law. "What kind of information might that be?"
"What do you know about Jim Harrison?" Claire said.
"Jim Harrison? The Jim Harrison who works for Morris?"
"Right. He supposedly handles special investigations for the district attorney, but he never brings any cases. Have you ever seen him in a courtroom trying a case or conducting a hearing?"
"Come to think of it, no, I haven't."
"That's because his real job is, for lack of a better term, bagman for the district attorney."
"Bagman?
You're familiar with the term, correct?"
"Of course I'm familiar with the term. A bagman is a collection boy, a courier. He picks up money from one place and delivers it to another."
"Dirty money," Claire said.
"And he picks this money up from whom and takes it to whom?"
"He picks it up from the Knox County Sheriff and gives it to Stephen Morris. I'm sure he keeps a small piece for himself."
"And where is the Knox County Sheriff getting this money?"
"Various people. Pimps, operators of gambling establishments and strip clubs, cockfighting and dogfighting promoters, bare-knuckle fighting promoters, human traffickers."
Janie looked startled. She quickly drained her beer and asked me for another one. I reached into the cooler and pulled one out, popped the top, and handed it to her. I was as confounded as she was. When we left the boat dock earlier, I had no idea the conversation was going to go this way. Janie took a long drink of the second beer, wiped her mouth, and said, "Forgive me, Miss Tate, I have all the respect in the world for you and for your grandfather, but what you're telling me is explosive stuff. Do you have any evidence that any of it is true?"
"We've only recently become aware of the extent of the corruption in Knox County involving the sheriff and the district attorney. We were hoping that you might be able to develop some sources and expose what's going on."
"Just in time to get your candidate elected," Janie said. Claire's eyes flashed, and I saw Janie cringe. Claire was definitely the more formidable of the two women.
"My candidate will be elected by a landslide whether you do this or not," she said.
"Then why are you telling me this? Why don't you get the TBI or the FBI involved?"
"The TBI is tricky," Claire said. "They work very closely with the district attorney. As a matter of fact, they won't even investigate a case unless the district attorney asks them to, and obviously Morris hasn't asked them. If we tried to go around him, we're afraid someone close to Morris might tip him off, and he'll shut everything down before we can prove anything. The current presidential administration has changed the FBI's mandate. Their primary task is counterterrorism. They don't care much about whether a redneck sheriff and a DA in Nowhere, Tennessee are shaking down vice peddlers and drug dealers. So that leaves it to someone like you."
You can work quietly, be cautious and inconspicuous, but you'll have to work pretty quickly. We'll help any way we can. When the time is right, pounce on them and print your story.
And wind up in a landfill somewhere, Janie said as she drained the second can of beer and tossed it at me. I pulled another out of the cooler and handed it to her.
You certainly don't have to do a thing, Claire said. I'm just making you aware of a situation. You can do what you wish with the information. If you think some harm might come to you, then by all means stay away from it. Darren, of course, will do everything he can to put a stop to the corruption on his end after he takes office. Perhaps, down the road, he can deal with the sheriff.
Maybe he ought to just kill him, Janie said. She was taking large gulps of the beer.
Beg your pardon? Claire said.
The word around the cop campfire is that your candidate has bagged a few, she said. Not true, I said. It was the first time I'd opened my mouth. Claire had told me to let her do the talking, and up until that moment I'd done so. I had often heard that criminal defendants, after telling themselves and everyone else they didn't commit a crime over an extended period of time, actually began to believe it. I knew exactly what I'd done, but it had become instinctive to deny I'd killed anyone.
How much more beer you got in there?
Janie said as she took a long drink from the can. There's one left, I looked at Claire. You want to head up river and get some more? I only brought six.
I like beer, Janie said. I don't think we'll need any more, Claire said. Why don't you pull up the anchor and let's stop back? Janie can drink the last one on the way.
I did as Claire requested and started the boat back toward the dock.
So you've never killed anybody?
Janie said. No, I said. Swear? I swear. She obviously didn't drink much.
Pinky swear?
I've never killed anyone. The questions you should be asking are why nobody was ever arrested for my mother's death, why Ben Clancy has never been found, and what happened to the doctor who killed my daughter and girlfriend. All of those things happened under Morris's watch.
I don't let people tell me what questions to ask, thank you very much, she said.
Her words were becoming slurred now, and she was getting louder. Sorry, I said, no offense.
I don't suppose you know anything about that Marine that went missing recently, she said. I wrote a story about it a few days ago. Did you read it?
I did read your story, and no, I don't know anything about what happened to him.
You're responsible for everyone that goes missing around here, you know, she said. Just ask the Knoxville cops. I know a bunch of them. It's a standing joke with them. Somebody disappears, they say it must have been you that made them go away. They call you the Reaper.
Is that right? I said. I said the words silently a couple of times and imagined myself in a black hooded robe, carrying a scythe. I wouldn't have admitted it, but I liked the image.
You're not planning to print that, are you? Claire said.
No, I think that might be borderline libelous, since I've never seen a shred of concrete evidence that Mr. Street has ever harmed a soul.
That's good to know, Claire said. It's strange, though, Janie said.
She was looking at Claire, but she sounded as though she might be talking to herself.
Nobody even seems mad at him. I've heard a lot of cops say if he did kill those two guys in West Virginia, they deserved it. And if he killed Clancy, he deserved it, too. This doctor? He's a hot topic of conversation right now. Nobody knows all the details, so nobody knows quite what to think. Our so-called medical reporter has been looking into it, but he's an idiot. He won't come up with anything. What happened at the birthing center, Mr. Street, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't think he should answer that question, Claire said. I'm sure there will be litigation. The court file will be public record. You'll be able to find all the information you need there. We cruised back to the dock at a much faster speed than we'd cruised out. I tied the boat off while Claire and Janie gathered their purses and towels. I picked up the cooler and climbed off the boat. Janie was already walking to her car. What just happened? I said to Claire. Was that a disaster?
Not at all, Claire said. Let me deal with it.
I thought the plan was for me to get into office and then take down the sheriff. When did you decide to bring her into the picture?
After you left Miss Tipton's,
My grandfather and I stayed and talked some more with Miss Tipton. We decided it might be best to change the plan then.
By bringing a reporter in? Why?
Because Granny thinks if the sheriff presses you, if he backs you into a corner, if he tries to do harm to you somehow, you'll kill him. And we don't want you killing anyone, especially the sheriff.
I was a little surprised that Granny would express such an opinion to the senator and Claire, but given my history of showing up at her house with bodies, I could understand to some degree. I promise I'll try not to kill anyone, I said.
Don't let it hurt your feelings. We can use this woman.
She appears to be a drunk, which makes her unpredictable.
Again, I'm sorry to say this, but we think that even though she drinks too much, she's not as unpredictable as you. She's been working at that paper for 25 years. I knew she was a boozer, but it doesn't affect her work.
Are you going to talk to her again?
Of course. I'll be at her front door this evening. We'll have a chat. She doesn't have a husband, so it'll just be us girls and her cats.
You know she has cats?
I do my homework, Mr. Street.
And what will you chat about?
Her future. Or rather, her lack thereof, if she doesn't treat us fairly. We have a lot of friends in the newspaper business, including the company that owns the paper she works for. Try to behave yourself, Mr. Street. I'll call you tonight.
Chapter 20. The press conference was an interesting experience. Claire organized it, and it was held in a meeting room at a hotel in downtown Knoxville. 3 television stations showed up, all the major networks that still did evening newscasts, and 3 print reporters. Janie Schofield was one of them. Claire had coached me for hours the day before, and I did fine. It was a blonde from one of the network TV affiliates who asked the question,
Mr. Street, I'm sure you're aware that there have been allegations that you've committed at least one and perhaps several murders over the past 2 years, she said. Would you care to comment?
I did what I'd always done. I denied the allegations. I also went on the offensive, hammering on the fact that there was absolutely no evidence against me and not a single witness had come forward. I questioned Stephen Morris's abilities, given the fact that he had several unsolved murders in his district. The ones I'd committed weren't the only killings that had gone unsolved during his tenure. I also cited some facts Claire had given me about the unusually large number of cases pending in the criminal courts of Knox County because the district attorney's office was unorganized and continued cases on a regular basis. I told people that I had been on the wrong side of the criminal justice system, that I had been falsely accused and convicted, and that I wanted to do everything in my power to see that false accusations and imprisonments became a thing of the past. I ended by pointing out that the murderer or murderers of my mother had never been brought to justice. I never said a word about Ben Clancy other than to deny I had anything to do with his disappearance. They seemed to buy it, and the whole thing lasted less than a half hour. The resulting stories were generally positive, and Claire seemed pleased. Then, over the next several weeks, I learned the true meaning of humility. Not humiliation. I'd suffered plenty of that at the hands of Ben Clancy and the many prison guards I'd known, but humility. I learned to be humble, and I did it visiting with groups like the Raritan Club, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Rotary Club, and the dozens of other community organizations in and around Knoxville. I would usually speak briefly after we'd eaten chicken or spaghetti or lasagna or whatever the group happened to be serving that evening, but I quickly found that the most valuable part of the interaction was listening. I'd always been a fairly good listener, but when I was hearing stories of children throwing their lives away to methamphetamine or opioids, stories of children and old people neglected and beaten and treated like animals, it affected me deeply. I heard stories of victims of rape and murder and armed robbery and how those incidents traumatized not only their victims, but also spread through entire families, like the ripples from a rock being thrown into a calm country pond. Those stories changed my perspective on the nature of crimes and those who commit them. It also made me want to help protect people. Even if I didn't get elected, I knew I would never again defend a criminal.
As September rolled into October and the election grew ever closer, I found myself walking in the door at night, exhausted, thinking about the families of the people I'd killed. I knew one of the boys in West Virginia, Donnie Frazier, had had a girlfriend. He'd probably had other family as well. I didn't know whether his mother and father were alive, whether he had aunts or uncles or cousins or nieces or nephews who may have been affected by his death. But he probably had. It was the same with Tommy Bean, the other man I'd killed in West Virginia, and Ben Clancy and Big Pappy Donovan, and now Dr. Nicholas Fratura. How had my committing the ultimate crime, the taking of another human being's life, affected those around my victims? It was the first time I'd ever thought in those terms, and the only reason these thoughts entered my mind was because of the stories I'd heard while campaigning. I'd really never given a damn about the families or friends of my own victims. They had done terrible things to me or to people I loved. I'd made the decision to kill them, and I'd done it and moved on without reflection. I couldn't exactly describe the feelings I was experiencing as guilt, but for the first time there were at least the beginnings of some regret. On a Wednesday evening, I'd just settled in at my apartment after meeting with a group of particularly cantankerous members of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Many had had loved ones killed or maimed by drunk drivers, and some had been seriously injured themselves. They'd wanted to make damn sure that I knew how they felt about prosecuting drunk driving cases. Claire was standing in the back while I was peppered with questions. I told them the truth. I told them I'd prosecute drunk drivers to the extent the law would allow. There were always new laws being proposed in the state legislature to make the penalties for DUI harsher. Tennessee, in fact, had some of the toughest laws in the United States, but some of the members of the group would be satisfied with nothing short of the death penalty. The doorbell rang around 10, and I immediately popped off the couch and headed into the bedroom, where I pulled my Walther P-22 pistol from beneath the mattress. I held the pistol in my hand as I walked toward the door. There was a small foyer and a short hallway leading away from my front door. I didn't want someone to shoot me through the door, so I stopped where the hallway opened onto the kitchen and said loudly, "Who is it?"
"It's Claire."
"One second," I said, and I jogged back to the bedroom and put the pistol back under the mattress. I walked back quickly and opened the door.
"Catch you at a bad time?" she said.
"Nope. Just had to put my gun away. Figured you wouldn't appreciate being greeted that way."
"How considerate of you. Why do you have a gun?"
"For protection."
"From whom?"
"People who might want to do me harm."
"Can you give me an example of someone who might want to do you harm?"
"Oh, I don't know. The sheriff, maybe, or one of his cronies. The sheriff's nephew. Stephen Morris, or one of his cronies. Family members of people who may have heard ugly rumors about me. Old friends from federal prison."
"I see," she said. "Long list. Have I come at a bad time? Can you talk?"
"No, not at all. It's fine. I was just unwinding. Tonight was pretty intense."
"I don't see any alcohol anywhere. How do you unwind?"
"I was just sitting on the couch thinking. I have a couple of beers in the fridge, maybe a bottle of wine in the cupboard. Can I offer you something?"
"A glass of wine would be nice," she said.
I rarely drink wine and didn't even know what I had in the cupboard. As it turned out, there were two decent bottles in there. One of them Grace's favorite. "Grace loved this stuff," I said, holding it up. "Will this do for you?"
"Perfectly," Claire said.
I uncorked the bottle and poured two glasses. Claire took one and sat down on the couch. I sat at the other end.
"You did a good job tonight," she said. "That was a tough crowd, and you handled them beautifully."
"Thanks," I said. "I'm trying to get better at it."
"You're a natural. You've gotten some confidence, and people are drawn to you."
"So how do you think things are going?" I said. "Do I have a chance?"
"All of our information shows that you're going to beat him by at least 5,000 votes, and we're not even finished with him yet. Do you know he bullies the principals at the schools his children attend? He threatens to sue them if they so much as breathe in the direction of one of his children. And his children, from everything I've gathered, are entitled brats. His wife slapped a male teacher across the face a month ago, and he refused to allow the police to do anything about it. Here's a 13-year-old girl who was texting in class. The teacher took her phone, gave it back to her at the end of class, and within an hour, Mrs. Morris was in this teacher's face, screaming at him. When he told her he understood why her daughter acted the way she does, she slapped him. He had a handprint on his face for 3 days. Once that gets out, along with a couple of other things we have planned, you'll be home free. And that doesn't even take into account my grandfather's endorsement. That will be a spectacle. Wait and see.
This is all great. Thank you. I really appreciate everything you're doing. I mean that. The only problem is that I'll have absolutely no idea what I'm doing when I go into the office. I mean, I wonder how many of the lawyers will quit, how many of them will give me a hard time, how many of them will have had problems with Morris and expect me to remedy them immediately.
He's run a pretty loose ship, Claire said. You'll have some work to do. Have you been studying how other district attorneys organize?
I have. I think I'll figure it out pretty quickly. I just don't think that part of it is going to be much fun.
Delegate, 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 she said.
Need a job? I said. I'm going to fire the bagman the first day if he doesn't quit. You can take his place and get things organized.
Thanks, she said. She had a beautiful smile. I think I'll head back to Washington when I'm finished here. I miss the swamp. Listen, Darren, there's something we need to talk about.
I set the glass down on the table and looked at her. Do you realize that's the first time your stuffy ass has managed to chill out enough to call me Darren? I said.
I think it's time we can become a bit more familiar, she said. Not too familiar, of course, and I don't appreciate you calling me a stuffy ass.
Not that I wanted to become too familiar with her. Grace was still too close, her memory too fresh. Claire was attractive, though. Damned attractive. I apologize, I said, but I'm glad you've decided to call me Darren. Mr. Street makes me feel old. What do we need to talk about?
Gary Brewer.
The Marine? I thought I had been deemed too unstable for that assignment.
Janie Schofield is terrified. She's making absolutely no progress. Grandfather wants you to get involved.
Okay, I said. What do I need to do?
Meet with the U.S. Attorney.
Stephen Blackburn had been the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Tennessee when the feds put me in jail. But Blackburn was gone. There had been a presidential election, and the new president, as was his right, had fired all the U.S. attorneys. Blackburn had been replaced with a man named Thomas Henshaw. I knew nothing about him other than he was well-connected, like all U.S. attorneys, and he had a reputation for enjoying old scotch and expensive cigars. Henshaw was to the feds what I would be to Knoxville, only he had a hell of a lot more on his plate. He oversaw the office that prosecuted all the criminal cases in federal court in 41 counties in eastern and part of middle Tennessee. He also had many other duties. I didn't envy the man at all. When are we supposed to meet him?
Tomorrow at 2, his office.
So you've already made the appointment. You coming?
Wouldn't miss it.
Chapter 21. I could tell U.S. Attorney Thomas Henshaw was unhappy that I was in his office. He was unhappy that the granddaughter of the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee was in his office, and he was unhappy that a deputy director from the FBI office in Washington and a deputy director from the Department of Justice had gotten him on a conference call and basically ordered him to meet with us and devise a plan to end the corruption that was going on in Knox County, and to find out what happened to Gary Brewer in the process. Henshaw was a husky man, around 60, with silver hair, brown eyes, and bushy, dark eyebrows. He had the jowls of a bulldog. An unlit cigar dangled from his lips, and deep lines etched his forehead. He was scowling. His eyebrows were arched and his thin lips were tight, almost pouty. The office was typical of a U.S. attorney, a framed photograph of the president hung on the wall behind his desk. American and Tennessee flags stood in the corners. There were shelves of law books, photos of dignitaries, and a large seal of the Department of Justice, with its qui pro domina justitas sequitur motto, which means, who prosecutes on behalf of the Lady Justice, on the front of Henshaw's desk. I looked at the seal for a few minutes, studying it. It depicted a bald eagle rising above a shield of red, white, and blue and holding an olive branch in its right talon and 13 arrows in its left. I supposed the significance of the olive branch and the arrows had something to do with tempering justice with mercy. Also in attendance was Bradley Kurtz, special agent in charge of the FBI office in Knoxville. All the agents who were there when I was framed and convicted of murder had been reassigned to other parts of the country. Kurtz was around 45, tall and lean, and looked like his face should be on a recruiting poster for the Gestapo. He had crystal blue eyes, blonde hair, and a face that was all sharp angles and thin lines.
"Thank you for meeting with us," Claire said after everyone settled in and it became obvious that Henshaw wasn't going to say a word.
"I didn't vote for your father, Miss Tate," Henshaw said. "I hold his office by appointment of the president, but I've been told that you need our assistance and that I am to be at your service. I'm not accustomed to being at anyone's service."
"We don't want you to be at our service," Claire said. "You serve the people of the Eastern District of Tennessee, correct?"
Henshaw snorted.
"They need your service because their public officials are allowing criminals to ply their trade unmolested, with one very important exception. The public officials extort money from the criminals in exchange for allowing them to operate."
"So?" Henshaw said. "Did you see what the United States Supreme Court did last summer, Ms. Tate? You live in Washington, right? I'm sure you read the Bob McDonnell case. The governor of the great state of Virginia took $175,000 in bribes from one man, was convicted by a jury, and the Supreme Court reversed the case. They said the trial judge's interpretation of a political act was too broad. In my opinion, what they did was give elected officials the right to do whatever they want and charge whatever they want to do it."
"This case is far different," Claire said, "and I think you know it."
"I don't know a thing about your case. We live in a dangerous world right now," Henshaw said. "Mr. Kurtz here concerns himself with things like terrorism and making sure some crazy person with a gun doesn't go into a school and shoot a bunch of kids. He deals with all kinds of human trafficking, people selling babies, people selling young girls for sex. He deals with cybercrime, which is probably the fastest growing area of crime in the world right now. He deals on occasion with large amounts of narcotics, and he does this in not one, but 41 counties. I help and advise him. I prosecute the cases he and his agents bring. We're all very, very busy. And now you're asking us to... what exactly do you want us to do?"
"Build a case against the sheriff of Knox County, the district attorney general of Knox County, and their associates. Prosecute them and put them in prison."
"For what?"
"Official misconduct. They're extorting money from criminals. Are you deaf?"
"I hear quite well, Ms. Tate, and you can keep the sarcasm to yourself. How much are we talking about?"
"I don't know exactly, but they're getting a piece of the proceeds from illegal gambling on cockfights, dogfights, bare-knuckle boxing, and unlicensed casinos. They also get a cut of all the prostitution that goes on in the county, and almost all the drugs that are sold in the county. My understanding is that it started when a former employee of this office, Ben Clancy, was the district attorney. So it's been going on for quite some time. I'm sure we're talking about millions of dollars."
Henshaw looked over at me like I was an insect. "Forgive me," he said to Claire, "but why is this man here?"
"Because he's going to be the next district attorney, and he wants to help."
"You're sure he's going to win the election?"
"Are you a gambling man, Mr. Henshaw?"
"Just tell me what you have in mind."
"Mr. Street has already been approached by the sheriff. He was just feeling Mr. Street out, trying to discern whether he would allow things to continue as they are if he were to be elected."
"And what did Mr. Street tell him?"
"Nothing, really. He doesn't trust the sheriff, but my grandfather would like to get Mr. Street involved in this case, and that's where you come in. After he's elected, Mr. Street is going to approach the sheriff and tell him he wants a full share of the protection and extortion money that's flowing to law enforcement in Knox County."
"I am?" I said. This came as a complete surprise. Claire ignored me and kept talking.
"He's going to record every conversation, turn all the money over to the FBI, and let you gentlemen do what you do. He'll do most of the work, and you can be the heroes."
"I'm not really comfortable with this," I said. Kurtz cleared his throat.
There will have to be an agent, probably two, nearby every time he talks to the sheriff. We'd have to be there in case a dangerous situation developed and to authenticate the tape recordings if the case goes to trial. We have to transcribe the tapes. We have to log and store everything. It's actually a great deal of work, Ms. Tate, and you're mistaken when you say he'll be doing most of it. It's offensive.
My apologies, Claire said. I certainly didn't mean to offend you.
This isn't something new to us, you know, Kurtz said. We've been aware of the accusations and innuendo for quite some time.
It goes far beyond accusation and innuendo, I assure you, Claire said. May I ask what you've done with the information you've received?
No, you may not. I'm not at liberty to discuss investigations, Kurtz said.
So there is an investigation, Claire said.
I didn't say that.
So there isn't an investigation, Claire said.
I didn't say that either. I'm not going to discuss any investigation with you, Ms. Tate. And as for Mr. Street, there would be concerns. He's suspected of killing several people, including Ben Clancy.
I didn't kill Clancy or anybody else, I said.
Well, you've also been charged and convicted of murder. You served 2 years in prison.
And I was exonerated, and Clancy was arrested and eventually put out to pasture.
The point is, let's say you were able to make a case on the sheriff and perhaps some of his associates. If the sheriff doesn't buckle and plead guilty, if he goes to trial, Mr. Street will face a vicious attack from the defense. They'll go after him with both barrels blazing. His credibility will be destroyed, and that doesn't make for much of a witness.
I can handle it, I said. Besides, that's a long way off.
I think it's a big waste of time, Henshaw said. Let's say you manage to take this sheriff down. You think it's going to stop gambling and prostitution and drugs? People have been doing those things since they've been walking upright. And what about the district attorney? You say he's involved? How are you going to get to him if he's no longer the district attorney?
He lives large, I said. Shouldn't be much problem to prove that he couldn't have financed his lifestyle on his salary.
You're chasing your tail. As soon as you take the sheriff out of the picture, the vice trades you're talking about will just open up. There will be competition. People will get hurt.
So you condone what he's doing? I said.
I'm not condoning him taking money, but a lot of law enforcement officials allow select people to operate so they can keep some form of control over things. It's less violent that way.
Fine, I said. But let's at least get the corruption out of the sheriff's office. And there's another part of this that I'm surprised you haven't mentioned. Gary Brewer?
Ah, yes, Gary Brewer, Henshaw said. The junkie gambler who took up bare-knuckle fighting to pay for his habits. Probably got himself killed in a fight. We're supposed to feel sorry for him, though, because he was a Marine and his family is wealthy.
Wow, you are one compassionate son of a bitch, aren't you? I said.
Watch your mouth, Henshaw said.
I stood up and looked at Claire. Let's go. I said, we don't need these guys. The meeting reminded me of the one I had with Stephen Morris about Dr. Fratura. Both Henshaw and Kurtz had made up their minds they weren't going to help us before we'd walked into the room. The only reason they'd met with us at all was because of Roger Tate.
Sit back down, Darren, Claire said. We can work this out.
Do what your master tells you, Henshaw said to me. I don't like any of this, but I have bosses, and my bosses tell me I have to work with you. So sit down, shut your mouth, and let Mr. Kurtz, Ms. Tate, and me figure out how we're going to go about it.
Tell your bosses I told you to go to hell, I said. I don't want your help. I'll take the sheriff and the rest of them down myself after I'm elected. Then I'll go to the paper and tell them what a huge help you boys were. And with that, I walked out the door.
Chapter 22. Claire sounded furious over the phone, although I thought I detected a note of reluctant respect in her voice.
I don't know whether I've ever met anyone as pig-headed as you are, she said.
I was driving toward my apartment, and she just left Henshaw's office.
They're not interested, I said. Don't you understand? If they're not interested, if they feel like they're being forced to help us, they'll screw it up. They won't be committed. And if they screw up, there's a good chance I wind up dead.
But you don't just talk to a U.S. attorney and the special agent in charge of the Knoxville FBI the way you did, she said.
I didn't start the insolence, I said. Both of them were disrespectful to you and to me, and I'm not wired to put up with that kind of crap. I don't care who they think they are or what their titles are. To me, they're just men in suits who have the power of the U.S. government behind them.
How they use that power is up to them, but I hold them to a higher standard than they obviously hold themselves. The thought crossed my mind that what I'd just said about holding them to a higher standard was pompous, considering what I'd done in the past, but I let it go quickly.
"So what are you going to do, Darren?" Claire said. "How are you going to get to Corker and these other people? Do you even know the full extent of what's going on?"